Welcome, everyone, to another Baseball America Prospect Handbook podcast. Along with Ben Badler, I am John Manuel. I want to thank our friends at DraftDay.com for sponsoring the Prospect Handbook podcast. DraftDay.com is a new concept that offers short-term or daily fantasy sports games for real money. The concept is simple. You pick the day you want to play and set a fantasy lineup. If your picks perform well that day, you win. You can play for free or real money, and they award cold hard cash nightly to the top performing players. They've already awarded more than $10 million, and it's completely legal to play. DraftDay.com also has a new rapid fire game that takes 1 minute to play with huge payouts. Just pick between a few choices of players and choose the ones that will score the most points. It's that easy. All you need is 3 of 5 correct to double your money. DraftDay is offering a special offer to Baseball America listeners, so be sure to head to DraftDay.com and enter the promo code BAPODCAST, and that'll start you off with a free instant cash bonus. If you like free money, head to DraftDay.com and use promo code BAPODCAST. And thanks again to our friends at DraftDay.com for sponsoring the podcast this year. We've moved the Prospect Handbook podcast here to Monday just because Friday with the Prospect Handbook is so crammed. And usually we come in fresh Monday, Ben, and you and JJ usually talk a lot about last week's Prospect Handbook and Prospect Hot Sheet, and then kind of spin that ahead to what else is going on in the world of prospects. But this weekend, kind of the biggest news in the world of prospects was yet another free agent, and it just seems... Ben, he's not a free agent yet, but it just seems like the Cuban influx of players to Major League Baseball just keeps on growing. And it seems like it started with a trickle maybe 7, 8 years ago when you had Yunel Escobar enter the draft and Brian Pena kind of come in there. And you had Kendrys Morales. It seemed like, wow, maybe it won't get bigger than Jose Contreras in 2003 or Kendrys Morales soon after him. But Kendrys Morales got, what, $4 million? And was quite a bargain and has been a good major league player. And then Alexi Ramirez and Dion Viciado. And now it's just a flood. It's hard to keep up with. And, with what Yasiel Puig has done in the major leagues this year, just kind of how dynamic he's been. And now we have another name to throw into the mix in Jose Dariel Abreu, the burly right-handed hitting first baseman who's been one of the best hitters in Serie Nacional in recent years and on the Cuban national team. He was not on the Cuban team that you and I saw that played against the U.S. college national team this summer and lost all 5 of those games. But he was on Cuba's World Port team, a team that won that tournament in July. And he's clearly one of the top players in Cuba over the last 5 years, especially I think it can be argued one of the best hitter from a combination of hitting and power. So we're going to break down Jose Abreu a little bit today, and I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of how he got out and where he is and all those kind of things. But let's just focus on the evaluating the player, Ben. And is it safe to say in your mind that he's the best hitter in the last, say, take the last 5 years in total? Is he the best combination of hit ability and power in Serie Nacional?
I think of the guys who are there right now, just in terms of pure offensive ability, I think there's really, I don't think there's any argument about, from a performance standpoint, I don't think anybody has been better than him. I mean, it's he can hit. He can he has a pretty good approach at the plate in terms of plate discipline. He is prone to chasing some of the harder, better breaking balls off the plate. But then he just also has a ton of power too. Really, I mean, if you look at Cuba over the last 5 years, the best offensive players have got to be him, Cespedes. I mean, Cespedes was the guy who, everybody I talked to, pretty much every scout I talked to, was just raving about Yoenis Cespedes, not just for the offensive ability that he has, but the athleticism too.
Right.
And the ability to, he's playing more of a, some more corner outfield now, but you could put him in center field. He played center field in Cuba. He can run. He can throw. He's just an absolute dynamite athlete. I think a lot of, if you survey most scouts, and then I've talked to a lot of scouts about this, I think they felt that Cespedes, if you compare Cespedes versus Abreu or really anybody else who's in Cuba right now, or even compared to Puig at the time, although there was just less information known about Puig, it was a bit of a different situation with him. I think people viewed Cespedes as the top guy in Cuba.
Right.
Now, the money, I think, is going to be a little bit different just because people have looked at the success that Cespedes has had and some of these other Cuban hitters that have come over. Although it hasn't been, as I think as universal as some people think. There's, you know, certainly a lot of some guys in Cuba who've come over with big numbers who kind of struggled in the minor leagues even. But I think, you know, you look at Cespedes, you have Alfredo Despaigne, who's like, I mean, I stood next to him in Japan. I mean, I'm 5'10". He was a little bit shorter than me, a little heavier too. Also, he's got like a Kirby Puckett kind of guy, but just unbelievable bat speed. I saw him hit a ball 490 feet in batting practice, not exaggerating. It was unbelievable to watch him and Jose Abreu take BP. So, I mean, you take those guys, Ulieski Gurriel, who's, you know, now third baseman. He's like 29 years old, very inconsistent at international tournaments. But, you know, you look at those would be the top guys in Cuba. Every scout is going to be a little bit different on each one. But just in terms of the overall offensive package that Abreu brings, and like, you know, like we said in the story, there's a little bit of a split camp on how it's going to translate to major league pitching. But based on what he did in Cuba, I think you got to say he was the top offensive player in Cuba at the time that he left.
Yeah, and you know, bringing up some of the other names, I think it's a good place to start, because you've talked about, I mean, I actually just wrote this column recently after we saw the U.S. Cuba series and saw the last two games here in Cary and in Durham. And that Cuban team, you know, clearly wasn't their top team, but, you know, Jose Fernandez was on that team. We ranked him as their top prospect coming out of the WBC this year. Abreu was the number three Cuban on that list, number four overall on the list, but he was behind Fernandez and Gurriel, who are offer more defensive value. And that's, I guess, what stands out to me about Abreu. When you think about the Cuban players, and then the column I wrote, I could have done a sidebar on just the Cubans who – a Cuban team of big leaguers, guys who've just have defected. I'm not talking about, you know, Yonder Alonso's or Yasmani Grandal's, guys who came over when they were younger, or even Jose Fernandez. I think I cheated and put Jose Fernandez on that team. But the Cubans in the big leagues now, there are a lot of pretty good athletes. The only guys I think who, and Jose Abreu does not fall into that Alexi Ramirez or Puig or Cespedes athleticism camp, or Junel Escobar, Hechavarria, those kind of guys. I guess his closest comparisons among Cubans who've left recently and who have become big leaguers, Ben, are guys like Dion Viciedo and Kendry Morales. Bigger, physical, where the value is in the bat. That's fair to say, isn't it? I mean, is there another guy who's he's comparable to who's left Cuba in recent years?
No, it's a first base DH only body. He probably weighs, he's really big guy.
Yeah.
He probably weighs like 250 pounds. I think Cuba lists it like on their WBC roster. They listed him as at least 250 pounds, and they're pretty unforgiving when they list the heights and weights. It's not like you have guys in the States who are listed at 5'11" when they're, you know, 5'8", 5'9". They just say it pretty straight. So, he's, you know, it's big guy. There's no chance. You couldn't really put him in left field or like try to stick him at like third base the way the Tigers are doing with like Miguel Cabrera. He's got to play first base or he's got a DH. So there's, you know, like you said, it's not a lot of athleticism. The draw is the middle of the order power. And if you think the bat is going to translate against major league pitching, then you have a true middle of the lineup player.
Yeah, that's to me. And the thing is, so the one of the things we talked about yesterday before we recorded the podcast was the success of Cespedes and being a big hit in his first season, being a success, helping the Athletics of the postseason. All that helped beget the contract, for Yasiel Puig, and helped the Dodgers go all in on Puig, at least financially. I think there were a lot of factors there that played into. There was an unknown, but the Dodgers obviously trusted their scouts and had a lot of money to throw around with their new ownership, wanted to make a statement, all those things. Plus they, I think the Cespedes example made them at least have some confidence to throw all the money they did at Puig. Even though Abreu is not that kind of player, he almost seems like a safer bet in some ways, Ben, because of this track record of hitting. But at the same time, he's just not a, it's not a pure bat speed swing, right? I mean, this guy's It feels like this guy is a strength guy who has pretty impressive hand-eye coordination and just real feel for the barrel.
Yeah, if you watch him, and this is the thing with him, is it's just like Cespedes. Scouts have seen him at so many international tournaments over the last few years, or just like exhibition series. They were in Taiwan at the end of 2012. It wasn't like a big tournament that got a lot of play, but
right,
you know, scouts would go there and see him or see everybody on that Cuban team. And so they've seen him there. There's a lot of these Cuban games are broadcast on television. There's so much video of these guys. You can even see it on YouTube. So they know him extremely well, at least the teams that have done their homework on this guy. So if you see him on video, you can see some stuff where it's a little bit unconventional, and you do see a lot of stuff from a lot of Cuban hitters that are unconventional. I mean, Gurriel has like a big bat wrap. Jose Fernandez, you were talking about, I should have included him as one of the top hitters in Cuba, certainly more of like a flat swing guy,
right?
A high average, so than power. But obviously playing second base, middle of the diamond, gives him a lot of value in the prime of his career. But, you know, Fernandez has that like weird front foot where he kind of turns his back ankle to the pitcher. You see a lot of weird things in Cuba. Obviously, Despaigne's swing is, you know, long and hitchy and has all this stuff that you wouldn't teach in the United States. But you're in Cuba, you're facing guys who, I mean, you might face a guy like you know, like Jorge Ruiz, who we just wrote about, who's, you know, only 19 years old, or there's a few other guys there who can, you know, run their fastball up to the low 90s. But, you know, a lot of guys they're facing are, you know, trying to trick them with sliders, or they're throwing like 85, 88 miles an hour.
Right.
Talent, the level is there. It's, you know, some of the stuff that we can call it an inefficiency in his swing, but it's not. If you're in Cuba, it works for you. You know, why not do it if you're doing something that maybe helps you generate a little bit more power artificially in your swing rather than trying to, you know, stay short and compact to the ball. So, yeah, when you see Abreu, he has a little unconventional toe tap, and he cuts himself off, and he's almost like fighting his own body when he swings at an inner, you know, a pitch that's on the inner half. So there's some concerns about, like you said, with the bat speed, it's more strength than bat speed. So, all right, when the velocity starts getting up there, and, you know, he starts having to face all these guys who seems like everybody nowadays is throwing, you know, 95 plus out of the bullpen, and starters are throwing harder than ever too. Is that going to be an issue for him? You know, there's some scouts that do have question marks about that. Obviously those aren't going to be the ones that are going to sign him, because there are guys who do think that the power is going to translate, those are going to be the teams that are going to be in on him. So I do think that it's, you know, it's really hard to ignore the performance that he put up in Cuba and that he's done for the most part in international competition and at most places he's gone. But you're right. It's not, there's some things that he does where if you were scouting a guy in the United States, you'd say, all right, that might be a little bit of a pause. And I think it's going to be a pause for some scouts, just the way that his hitting mechanics work right now at the plate for him.
And Victor Mesa even said here in Durham in the last game, I got a chance to talk to him briefly. I think I've milked more comments out of this 5-minute interview that I did with him than most 5-minute interviews that I've had. But he just plainly said it, that the Cuban players have to adjust and have had a hard time adjusting to velocity. It's what you wrote. I think it's what you wrote when Puig was a free agent. I think it's what you wrote with Cespedes. I know you that was really reinforced during the WBC, where Cuba even had trouble with like Loke Van Mill, who's kind of been a journeyman reliever in the minor leagues, but was closing for the Netherlands and pitched against them. And it's odd to me that Cuba's had these issues internationally against top-level pitching, while at the same time, the Cuban players who have come to the big leagues have generally lived up to a lot of the hype. You know, I mean, Alexi Ramirez was not the star on Cuba's national team. In fact, he had to play outfield. And then now he's known in the major leagues for his defense at shortstop. You know, that's like his calling card. But Vicedo, who obviously was very young, but has turned into a fairly productive big league hitter, despite, you know, kind of having the right profile. I know he's having a little bit of a tough year this year, but the guy did hit, you know, 25 home runs in 2012 for the White Sox. There are a lot of productive hitters who are out of Cuba in the major leagues right now, and it feels like Abreu's, you know, I understand that, you know, you have to have a lot of confidence. You're going to have a lot of confidence in your evaluation of him because the money's going to be so big. But it does seem like there's a lot of reasons to have confidence that this guy's going to hit, Ben. The other part of this, I guess, for you know, the other piece of the puzzle is, you know, he is playing first base, and that usually is not, you know, he doesn't have as much, he doesn't really offer much defensive value. I think it's safe to say that, especially compared to the other guys we're talking about. But there aren't a lot of first, I mean, we've talked about this. I think you and JJ have talked about it in this Prospect Handbook podcast. There aren't a lot of first base prospects in the minor leagues. I mean, the day that he's cleared, let's say that this happens, the OFAC, and it's detailed in your story, he's got to get cleared by the U.S. government to be a free agent, establish residency elsewhere. He's got to be cleared by the U.S. government that this, basically that his money won't go back to Cuba, that the money will stay out of Cuba, whatever he's paid won't go back to Cuba. That's the oversimplification of this OFAC deal. But the day that he signs, he kind of goes to the front of the first base prospect line, does he not?
I mean, I don't like Jonathan Singleton. I like Jonathan Singleton, but he's he does. I don't think he compares right now. Certainly to, I mean, if Abreu and Singleton, you know, tomorrow are both named, you know, for whatever reason, unrestricted free agents.
Right.
I don't think there's any question that Abreu is going to get more money than Jonathan Singleton.
Yep.
I'd certainly take Abreu over him.
That's a great way to look at it, or like a Dan Vogelbach. I'm just trying to think of other first basemen. It's just the minor leagues, it's just not loaded with big-time first basemen. I was just debating this with JJ before we came on the podcast. I almost think I'd take Vogelbach just because I believe – not over Abreu, I mean over Singleton, because I believe in the pure hit ability. Maybe I'm following a couple of scouts' Twitter too much because they've loved seeing Vogelbach. But at the same time, I mean, that's what we're talking about. So Abreu's timing is – I think it's pretty fortuitous as far as he's coming along, but there's some position scarcity you know, at first base that there hasn't been in recent years. What are some fits, Ben? I mean, I know we're projecting into the future, and we should probably talk. I think these are some of the Twitter questions we've actually had. He's at Ben Badler. I'm at John Manuel BA. One of the questions, I believe, is you know, it's from Ben Gavoni is the Twitter name. What team do you guys feel is the front runner to sign him once he becomes a free agent? I don't know about front runner, but Ben, but where are some fits that you see for Jose Abreu? Let's project into this off season, if and when he does become a major league free agent.
Yeah, I mean that's no matter how much you know, whatever you think about Jose Abreu as a team. It obviously depends on the fit for him. It's not like you're signing with somebody like Jorge Soler or even like Yasiel Puig. I mean, Puig is a very different situation, so I'd throw him aside for now. But, you know, with Soler, it doesn't matter how much outfield depth or who you have in right field right now, you're signing a prospect. You know you're signing a prospect who's going to be in your system for at least a couple of years. You don't really worry about, you know, do we have a spot for him. With the Braves, if you're, well, I guess the Tigers may be able to wedge him in there, but you don't want to have Miguel Cabrera and Prince Fielder and Jose Abreu and trying to find a spot for all those three guys. If you're the Diamondbacks, you have Paul Goldschmidt. You're the Reds, you have Joey Votto. I mean, you might be, those teams, just for example, might be higher on Jose Abreu than anybody else in the world. It doesn't matter. They're not going to sign him because there's nowhere to play him.
Right.
So you look around who has a need at first base. I mean, a first team that jumps out is the Rangers. They, you know, team that has a history of signing Cuban players. Leonis Martin has worked out very well for them. A lot of scouts thought he was going to be a fourth outfielder. I was always higher on him than that. I think he's pretty much become what's, you know, the Rangers and other scouts who really liked him thought he was going to be. He was on their national team. He was an up and coming player in Cuba at the time that he left. So I'm not surprised at the season that he's having for them. But I think that would be the first team that jumps to mind for me. You know, you look at the major league free agent market for first baseman next year. I mean, are you going to throw a lot of money at, 32-year-old Mike Napoli, who had, health issues in the past? That's, I wouldn't want to throw a ton of money at that guy.
He's always been streaky. He's still a streaky hitter, and he's always been a streaky hitter.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of competition on the first base market for him. He's not going to be, he's not going to be getting like Cano or like Ellsbury money, I don't think. But you got to look at first base. I mean, so if Napoli leaves the Red Sox, now the Red Sox have a need of first base. They have a history of signing Cuban players, albeit, with sort of a previous regime, Jose Iglesias. Remember, they also – we can talk about all this wild success that, Cespedes and Puig are having. Juan Carlos Linares, who was, an outfielder in Cuba, put up great numbers, won gold gloves in Cuba, was in the prime of his career when he came over, wasn't like a huge, huge dollar sign. He hasn't hit at all. Jorge Padron is another guy who came over, hasn't really put up very big numbers either since he's come over. So it's not universal that just because you have success. Obviously Leslie Anderson too, with the Rays, although he's older, and I actually would like to see him get a shot.
Yeah, I agree.
But it just obviously success in Cuba or success in the major leagues also isn't really a guarantee of future success anywhere. But I mean, those two teams, the Red Sox and the Rangers, especially the Rangers, really jump out to me as teams with the need. The Pirates are another team. There was talk about them, being interested in Mike Stanton, which who wouldn't be interested in Mike Stanton, but,
right.
I could see that. I'd rather, if I were them, I'd rather keep, I mean, you have Starling Marte and Andrew McCutchen already. You have Gregory Polanco coming up. I mean, if they're one of the teams that likes Jose Abreu, if you're looking to add another bat, they're going to make the playoffs. They're going to get a boost in revenue this year. I could see them being a team that would be interested in Jose Abreu and trying to upgrade there if they're a team that's on. I mean, you look around some of the other teams in the league.
You hit the three high notes, though, for me. I think those were exactly the three teams. I don't mean to interrupt you, but to me, Texas and Boston and Pittsburgh stuck out from the crowd just because Boston, because they have the financial flexibility and there's not a clear future first baseman there. Right-handed power, Fenway Park makes a lot of sense. Texas, again, there's an obvious offensive need with Nelson Cruz and Biogenesis. He's a free agent. Mm-hmm. Right-handed power, especially in the short term, because they certainly have prospects. I still think they're a team that makes a lot of sense for a Stanton trade, but if you don't want to use your prospects for that, you hold on to some of those guys.
Theoretically, they could sign Jose Abreu, put him at first base. And I agree that they're a lot thinner at first base. Ronald Guzman I like, but he's way far away.
Right. The guy who was their immediate fix at first base, if you look at it from that perspective, was Mike Gold, and they just traded him.
Yeah. So you could do that. And then even then, so now you have even more of a need if Nelson Cruz leaves, which I think he probably will. Right. Even if you do that now, they still have, you could, if they wanted to, I don't think they're going to trade Jurickson Profar. But I mean, they have the prospects to even then on top of that, pull off a Stanton trade, which would be pretty scary.
Absolutely. And the other team I wanted to throw out to you that is in that group for me was the Nationals, just because they're coming off a disappointing year. I think it's unlikely that they're going to make the playoffs this year. I think that's safe to say, considering how far out they are. Even in the wild card in the National League, they're under 500. But this is clearly a team that I don't think they're going to go into 2014 thinking it's a rebuild. They're going to go in trying to get back to their 2012 level. And while I know there are a lot of questions about Ryan Zimmerman's future position, you're talking about Adam LaRoche's struggles at first base this year. He's 35. Abreu would seem to – and it seemed like one of the things – one of the guys they missed the most this year. I know there are a lot of reasons why the Nationals struggled this year. Some of their middle relievers regressing. Back end of the rotation was pretty poor this year. But they really seemed like they missed Mike Morse's right-handed power in that lineup. And, Abreu kind of is that right-handed bat who would slide right in, and they don't have an obvious first base answer next year if they cut bait on LaRoche. So I was going to throw the Nationals out to you. I don't, off the top of my head, the only Cuban I know the Nationals have been tied to in recent years has been Yunesky Maya, and that signing didn't go great for them, although sometimes you wonder if maybe they should have given him a shot at the way the back of their rotation has gone this year. But Mike Rizzo, could you see the Nationals and Mike Rizzo making a play for Abreu at first base?
I could see them being I could definitely see them having interest in him. Like you said, they signed Maya. That was really what, after they got rid of a bunch of people there,
right,
who were previously running their international scouting.
Yes, the post Jose Rijo cleanup, the post Miley Gonzalez cleanup.
Yeah, so once they brought in their new crew, that was really like the first big international signing they made. And again, he was not, I mean, Yunesky Maya has not been very good. And he was an outstanding pitcher in Cuba.
He was basically their ace in Cuba. I mean, he was the best guy left standing for a while on their national
team. Yeah, we talk about, Miguel Gonzalez now. I mean, Gonzalez throws harder than Maya ever did, but it's in terms of performance, I think it's comparable.
Very much so.
Maya had more feel for pitching than Miguel Gonzalez did, I think, and that's what a lot of scouts I've talked to think too. Although I know a lot of scouts think Gonzalez is ahead of Maya in terms of the stuff, but I think I think that's one of the reasons that you see that the Nationals haven't really gone full bore back into the international market is because they tried to with Maya, it didn't work out, and I think that might cause them a little bit of hesitancy. But I can see them being more involved. I'm trying to think back. I'm trying to think of Johnny DePuglia, who runs their international scouting. I'm pretty sure he was with the Red Sox when they signed Jose Iglesias. So, I'm sure they know the Cuban players, and I'm sure they know Jose Abreu extremely well. But like you said, it's, what's going to happen with Zimmerman? If you're an American League team, you have a little bit more flexibility because you have that DH option, whether it's for Abreu or for somebody else that you want to put there. But if you're in the National League, you really have to have, there's teams that could use him as an upgrade, but there's just nowhere. Is it enough of an upgrade? And is there going to be a spot to put the other guy? There's the American League teams, I think, certainly have an advantage in this situation.
And Ben, I think it's, one of the consistent Twitter questions we have, I'm just checking our feed, it really does seem a lot of people are asking, can this guy play another position? It sounds like, just looking at him, you don't see too many 6'3", 250 left fielders in pro ball. He's probably limited to first base, right?
Yeah, and I think, it's interesting. A lot of guys come over from Cuba and, their bodies improve. They get in better shape. They get into better conditioning. In Cuba, it's tough. I mean, we were at that series when the United States, when Cuba came over to the United States to play the U.S. college national team, and there were a lot of guys, just to be blunt, like, they just had guts.
Yeah, no doubt. Soft there was bodies.
There was one guy who, right before they were taking the field to go start warming up, was eating a bag of chips. I mean, it's very unusual to see. I mean, look, like Alexander Guerrero, this shortstop who came over from Cuba, really good offensive numbers in Cuba, never stole bases in Cuba. Now he's, running plus times. And he's really transformed his body. A lot of times, I think that's probably going to happen with Abreu. I think he's probably going to, trim down a little bit. Obviously, scouts have concerns about the body, but it's you're not going to get him to, down to like 220 or something, and he's going to be up there running around in right field or left field or something like that. You got to put him at first base or DH only.
Even if he's not fat, he's big boned. That's for sure. I mean,
he's just a big, heavy guy. It's not a lot of, at least like Cabrera. Like you can, I don't like Cabrera. I think Cabrera is actually he's a terrible defensive third baseman. But he's even with him, you know, he has some experience before playing third base. He has the arm strength to play there. It's not like his hands are terrible, but.
It's a fitness issue, really, with Miguel Cabrera, and a size issue. He's gotten more fit, but he's also just too big to play third base now.
And if that is your absolute bar, like bare minimum for playing third base, and my bar would be a little bit higher than that, but I understand why the Tigers do it.
Yep.
If that's it, then I mean, Abreu is clearly below him. It's like we said, it's just first base or DH only with him.
Yep. I'll just run through a lot of these Twitter questions, and we've talked about a lot of them, but one quick thing, and then I'll get to this. I always think that this is the most interesting thing over my time at BA with the Cuban guys, is that when you're signing a Cuban player, first off, what you said with Guerrero is interesting, because very few of these guys come to the United States and get skinnier. You know, it just doesn't happen. I can't blame any of them. They're coming to a land of gluttony, frankly, and they're given giant checkbooks that they never had, and I don't think it's very difficult to expect a guy who's coming from a situation of want. I'm not judging their political system or economic system or anything, but coming from a situation where you don't have everything you want to where now you can have almost literally anything you want, and to expect them to be ridiculously disciplined and about their diet and about their workouts, I just think that's too much to expect. And for every El Duque who's come over, and El Duque was a unique athlete who maintained an unbelievable physique and physical ability. For every El Duque, you have like 10 Levons who get big, or Contreras who didn't get sloppy big, but this was bigger than he had been in Cuba. And I think it was difficult for him to handle, that different lifestyle. So the biggest separating factor between Major League Baseball and everything else in the world is the grind. And Cuba's Serie Nacional is 90 games in a regular year. So you're basically playing a little bit more of a short, it's closer to a New York Penn League schedule than it is to a Major League Baseball schedule.
That might be a concern with Abreu too. I mean, he has a history. I mean, he was a shoulder injury. He sat out.
Great point.
Some time in the World Poor Tournament that they just came off with an injury too.
Right. Durability is a question for any player, any nationality, American, Dominican, Japanese, whatever. But especially when you've played and your muscle memory is a 90 game season and then some tournaments. And that's not what Jose Abreu has to get ready for. So I think those factors are always unknowns, and for any Cuban player, not just specific to Abreu. But I think the fitness issue. Yeah, I specifically asked a couple of scouts during that USA Cuba series, and I asked a guy with USA Baseball, Eric Campbell. His thoughts on we were talking about pitcher velocity in Cuba, like you were talking about. And one of his points was, well, I'm not going to say that what we do here is better. It's just different. And that's something you get the more you talk to scouts who have a lot of international experience. I'm wondering if you've gotten that, Ben, because my take is almost always from guys who've coached with USA Baseball, like Ernie Young or Kirk Champion, or guys who've been on these coaching staffs. And their opinion always seems to be, well, they do things different over there. Or the college guys, I don't know if what we do is better. I think what we do is better, but I'm not sure, because what they do works for them. But I wonder, do scouts think the same thing, or do they think that what they do in Cuba is as good, or do they view it like as different, or do they view it as inferior in terms of training and all that kind of stuff?
I think you and I could probably talk about this for like 3 hours.
Yeah, I was afraid to bring it up in the podcast, but I had to go there.
Because I think it's very multidimensional. One, I think that over time, I think the individual countries, and remember, Cuba is it's not like Japan where you can bring in foreign imports, or the United States, where you're bringing in players from all different places. Also, Cuba is completely closed off. It's only Cuban-born players who are in there who haven't left Cuba.
That's always fascinating to me, Ben, that like even they have relations with other countries. I'm always surprised. Like even I wondered this a few years ago. Like, would Venezuelan guys who wash out in the U.S. minors try to go play in Cuba maybe? Because the Cuba and Venezuela had these relationships. But that never happened. I mean, even no matter how much Cuba and Venezuela had these economic ties and these political ties, you know, Cuba's league stayed all Cuban, which I just think was fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to be – well, obviously they don't pay, you know, the players. Yeah. You'd have to be like a complete washout, nothing else
right.
going on, and you want to, you know, go and live in Cuba. But to me, what stands out is I think countries – the way that baseball develops in those countries evolves, you know, relative to do what's best to have success in that league.
Right.
So you see in Cuba, there's not a lot of guys who throw all that hard. So in the United States, if you're facing a guy who's throwing, you know, 95, 96 miles an hour, you can't have a long swing to the ball. And you've got to be able to do certain things, you know, what we consider more, you know, mechanically efficient to get to the ball, to get the bat head out there and to be able to, you know, be able to hit that pitch, but also adjust to, you know, really sharp off-speed pitches that you see here, too, in the United States, in the major leagues. Whereas in Cuba, you're facing a lot of guys who are probably throwing, you know, 85, 89 miles an hour. And also throwing you a lot of slop stuff. If you're, you know, Yulieski Gurriel or some other, you know, Cuban hitter with a ton of power, you can have a, you know, a like Gurriel has this exaggerated bat wrap where he's basically pointing the bat head or the end of the bat directly at the pitcher.
Yeah, it's almost like it's 3 o'clock. If you look at the clock hands. The bat's like 2:30 or 3 o'clock with Gurriel. I mean, he's really – it's exaggerated.
Yeah, so you develop – that would be – you know, there's guys in the United States over time who've done that and had success. But you wouldn't want to teach a hitter in the United States to do that. That would be something that you would typically want to change. But for him, one, he has just terrific bat speed. So I think it actually – there's people who think it would probably work for him – in the United States anyway, but
it's like a Gary Sheffield type of stance. He doesn't have the wag, but he has the bat pointed kind of to slow himself down and get himself on time like Sheffield did, basically.
Yeah, so you see a lot of stuff like that where it's, okay, well, it doesn't work in the United States, but when you're in Cuba, all right, or like Alfredo Despaigne has that, you know, completely all-out swing for the fences swing. I mean, are you going to change him? I mean, how are you going to tell Alfredo Despaigne, who's won, you know, multiple MVP awards in Cuba,
right,
who consistently posts some of the best numbers there? I mean, how are you going to tell him what he's doing is wrong when what he's doing might be ideal for what for the competition level that he's facing? Now, if he has aspirations or they're trying to come over to the United States, it's a little bit different. There are more legitimate questions about whether that would play against major league pitching. But you see the same stuff in whether it's Cuba or whether it's Japan. Like, you see more guys throwing splitters and trying to pitch backwards a little bit more. A lot of those guys have like hooks or wraps in their arm action, or even just the college game. Like, what's optimal for winning in college baseball might not be optimal for having success in the minor leagues or having success in the major leagues. It's, I think people train and condition the players themselves, and it evolves over time to be optimal, or what they believe at least is optimal, to what best suits their environment. And I don't think that – I mean, I think – obviously, I think that major league teams develop players the way that they think is optimal, but I think that just because they do things a certain way that might be different from what they do – say in Japan or maybe even in the college game, doesn't necessarily mean that that's the authority on this is, you know, unquestionably the best way to do things.
Yeah, that's a good short version of that answer. And you mentioned Despaigne. You wrote about him earlier this year. He's playing in the Mexican League. He's playing professional baseball in Mexico. He's technically a AAA player this year with Campeche, with the Pirates. And he's hitting .338 there with 8 home runs in 33 games. Entirely predictable 27-4 strikeout-to-walk ratio. But this guy, what he does, he hits, and he's hit everywhere. He's been clutch. He seems like he always has big hits. I'm thinking of that game-winning home run he hit in 2011 against the U.S. college national team. Might have been 2010 in the FISU World Championship. This guy is a hitter with huge power, and I love that his Mexican League team lists him at 5'8", 214 pounds. So, you know, what is this guy? This is just atypical. And I think Cuban baseball is basically what college baseball would look like if it had a very closed pool of the best athletes and they all had to go play college baseball, because it's a similar schedule. And also a lot of these guys in Cuba use metal bats in international tournaments, and they use a lot of metal bats as amateurs, just like Americans do. And Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any Dominicans use metal bats, because if you're trying to get signed by a pro club, you're using wood bats when you're working with a trainer. You're working out with wood when you're 15, aren't you?
Yeah, and a lot of the Cubans are. I mean, it's now a lot of wood bat too. So that obviously helps a lot of the evaluations now. But yeah, I mean, unless you're in like the RBI program, I think uses metal bats at those international tournaments. But yeah, once you're with a trainer, once you're playing and trying out for teams, it's all wood.
Well, let's go back into some of these Twitter questions, because a lot of them come from these other players, and we should wrap up soon. Bob Maripol asked Alexander Guerrero and his status with OFAC and potential in Major League Baseball. And you just broke down Guerrero in a subscriber report the other day, I guess end of July, so I guess 2-3 weeks ago. And you mentioned him earlier in this podcast. This is a right-handed, power-hitting, potential middle infielder, it sounds like, Ben. Is that the short version?
Yeah, I mean, the teams that are the highest on him are going to see him as maybe a shortstop. I think he's going to be, if you put him at shortstop, he's going to be a below-average defender at shortstop.
Right.
I think most teams would say that his best fit is at second base. That, you know, the hands are fine there. It's better range to his left than to his right. So I think shortstop is a stretch for him. Although if some team really has a desperate need, you might squeeze him in there. But what stands out with him is the teams that are the highest on him see him as an offensive-minded second baseman who, you know, the power is the draw with him. It's above average raw power, and he hit well in Cuba. It wasn't a 1-year fluke either. He has a track record of hitting over several years. What's interesting, I mean, about him, like, in, he's like 26 years old now. During international tournaments, they didn't really use Guerrero for whatever reason. That was the Cuban evaluation on him. Hmm. They would bring over, you know, Arizbel Barbaro Barruena.
Well done. That's a tough name.
And yeah, I think I spelled it wrong like 4 times when I wrote him up from the U.S. series.
It's like Rua Barruena. Like,
yeah,
but that's hard to remember.
So they would use him like us, and from a really young age too. And obviously, they don't even have Iglesias or Echeverria to use anymore. So it's remarkable they have three guys who are just outstanding defensive shortstops. So they would use him. They would use Leonidas Diaz, who was suspended for or declared ineligible to sign technically over issues with his age. And Guerrero didn't really get a lot of play in international tournaments. And I think when scouts saw him there, they were just kind of, they didn't really see it with him.
Right.
But it sounds like since he's gotten to Cuba, he's gotten in significantly better shape. He's running faster. He, like we said before, he's never really a big runner in Cuba. I mean, I think he was like 0-for-7 or something like that in like 4 straight years stealing bases. Was not a big runner at all.
And as we saw, with that Cuban team that came here to play the U.S. college national team, defensive catcher is not a deep position in Cuba.
Oh man, yeah, they have like they have Frank Moore at home,
yep,
who's still there, who's a really good defensive catcher, and Pastano is still, Ariel Pastano is still kicking around, a long time guy on their national team. But yeah, it's
that's my favorite part about Pastano is, you know, he, besides being the biggest jerk in international baseball, the biggest red ass in international baseball, is that outside of Morahone, I don't think he respects any of the other guys who've replaced him on any of these national teams. So he still snipes at the Cuban national team for not putting him on these teams, even though he supposedly retired 3 years ago. But he still, you see the Cuban media, he still snipes at the at Victor Mesa for picking other guys, which is just, you know, kind of laughable. But
yeah, they have another catcher too, who's like, well, Pablo Sandoval actually was a catcher in the minor leagues, and he was pretty good at it, I thought, at least in terms of throwing out runners. But they have another guy who looks just like a Cuban panda behind the plate. So it's, but with Guerrero, there's questions about whether the power is going to translate. Some guys see it as like a stiff uppercut swing. Other guys say it just kind of looks like an uppercut because of the way of his stance is. And they think it's maybe not a high average guy, but you know, if you have a middle infielder who can hit for power,
yep.
You know, in the current era, you know, maybe that's going to appeal to some teams, but I don't think teams see him. I know teams don't see him as like a premium guy along the lines of like a Cespedes or what Abreu is potentially going to be. I don't think teams see him along those lines, but I don't think it's going to stop him from signing a pretty good contract either. But as of now, I think my understanding is he still has not been unblocked by OFAC. So I don't think he's going to – I mean, I don't know when that's going to happen. My guess is at some point either this week or next week. But we're probably going to get a ton of questions on, well, when is Abreu going to be eligible to sign?
Right.
Well, this is a – you know, what should be a long process. Obviously, some players like Puig have had theirs – expedited. I'm not really sure how, but I think that at some point in the offseason, I think Abreu will be able to sign. If you look at like Cespedes last year or a couple of years ago, he left in, I won't say July, and I want to say he was cleared in either like February or March. So I think Abreu will be able to be cleared by then, and probably Guerrero at some point in the next couple of weeks.
One of the other questions we have is about what the heck is going on with Miguel Gonzalez and the Phillies. Another player that you wrote about when he became a free agent. There's a verbal, I think you even wrote about that he'd agreed to terms with the Phillies, but that contract hasn't been 100% consummated, it appears, and there's some complications. Real quick, Ben, I just found the box score from the USA-Cuba game in 2010. In Tokyo, in the I'm not sure what tournament this was, but
is that the Garrett Cole or
that's Gonzalez? That's the Gonzalez Garrett Cole matchup. But just listen to the Cuba lineup that Garrett Cole faced and shut out for 7 innings, only 2 strikeouts, but 10 hits allowed, but no runs, 91 pitches. Leonis Martin leading off in center field, Yoilan Cerce at second. I have to admit I'm not familiar with Cerce's work. Hector Oliveira, who has missed the last 2 years with what is reported to be a blood disorder. And there's always reason to be some skepticism with Cuban players because maybe he tried to defect and failed.
He's supposed to be coming back this year, and
right.
He's a stud.
And he is a stud. He was Jose Fernandez before there was Jose Fernandez, basically.
He's more athletic than Jose Fernandez.
And I was about to say, I believe the reports are more power and better chance to be a shortstop. So Hector Oliveira was a stud. So he hit 3-hole. Here's how much of a stud he was. He hit 3-hole, and listen to the rest of this lineup. 4-hole, Despaigne. 5-hole, Cespedes. 6-hole, Jose Abreu, who we're talking about here. Aldemus Diaz at third. I don't recognize his name.
He was the one who was the age issue with
okay, yep. I remember him now that you mentioned him. He had 3 hits in that game. Frank Morahone catching, who we just mentioned. And Yorbis Barroto, yet another athletic shortstop, in the 9-hole. Now, Miguel Gonzalez facing a U.S. lineup that was Drew Maggi, Nolan Fontana, personal cheeseball, Jackie Bradley, Ryan Wright, who had a great summer that year for Team USA, George Springer, who's in the running to be minor league player of the year, hitting 5-hole, Nick Ramirez, Jason Esposito, Mikey Matuk, and then catch-and-throw joker Steve Rodriguez behind the plate. So Gonzalez in that game, 9 2/3, 151 pitches, 8 hits, 3 runs, only 1 earned, 2 walks, 14 ponches. So that was a hell of a game. Would have loved to have been at that game. But Miguel Gonzalez, basically that was the peak of his career, seen at the time as maybe the next guy, the next Cuban national team ace. But he had some backsliding since then, Ben, it sounds like, and now there's these complications with him and the Phillies. How good of a prospect was he, say, compared to a Yunesky Maya, who we just talked about earlier in the podcast? How similar was he to Maya, and kind of what's the status there, if you know, as much as you can talk about?
Yeah, I think you hit it. The scouts who saw him at that tournament were the scouts who were the highest on him coming over. Now, there's also people who saw him in Mexico. I think a lot of American guys went in, saw him throwing really hard there, and started jumping up and down about him. But you're right. He's been a very good pitcher in Cuba. He throws harder than Maya. I think a little bit less feel for pitching. But it's a good fastball, usually like 89-93 as a starter, but he'll get up to 96 out of the bullpen, or if he ramps it up and really needs it. The issue right now is, you know, obviously there's something that's holding up his contract with the Phillies. What it is, I can't confirm that yet, but there's really three reasons why you would void or want to have a holdup in a contract. One, there's something with a physical. And Gonzalez, at some point in the last few years, had surgery to remove bone chips from his elbow. We wrote that he had elbow issues in the past. That's supposedly what happened with him in Cuba. So I could see something coming up with his elbow. I can't confirm that's what happened with the Phillies, but he does have a history of elbow issues, and there, some scouts see him as more of a reliever than a starter, so that wouldn't surprise me. The other thing that could happen is obviously, something comes up with a drug test. They're going to have to drug test him before he signs. I haven't heard anything about that yet, but that's another just general reason why you would void a contract. The other is
those are both very reasonable things to speculate about, I think.
The third reason you would attempt to get out of a contract, especially if he hasn't signed physically a contract yet, in which case you have nothing really, is that you change your mind, which happens internationally. I know there have been cases in the past at the amateur level in Latin America outside of the Cuban market where a team has agreed to sign a player for a lot of money, not this kind of money obviously, but relative terms for the 16 to 17 year old market, and then they realized, we way overbid for this guy, or why are we paying this guy this much money, or all of a sudden his fastball velocity is dropping, so we need to find a way to get out of this, so we will invent a reason to get out of it. So we'll say, there was an issue with his shoulder or his elbow or his, his ear or something just to get out of the contract or to get out of the agreement. So that's just the third general reason why you would try to get out of the contract or the agreement. So what happened in this case? Don't know yet. Can't confirm it, but those are just some of the general reasons why there could be a hesitation with an international signing in general, and certainly the elbow history with Gonzalez is going to be a red flag.
Ben, that's we've talked an awful lot of Cuban baseball today. Anything else you wanted to throw in about Cuba and also about Abreu? Feels like we've covered quite a bit of that. It's definitely been fun talking a little Cuban baseball. Anything else you wanted to add before I moved on real quick to the last week's prospect hot sheet?
No, I mean, it's, the average, I'm just on Baseball Reference right now. It's, looking at that, what the average first baseman is hitting in the major leagues this year is, it's 261, 336, 437. I mean, that's not a very high bar to be, you know, a league average, you know, offensive first base. Now, to be a regular, you got to hit a little bit better than that, obviously. But I think there's pretty significant upside with Abreu. Like we said, there's going to be a bit of a split camp on him, but I think that he's certainly a better prospect than Miguel Gonzalez. And if that's the market for him, it's going to be some significant dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say that. I mean, like Puig got $42 million, Cespedes and Chapman got in the 30s, and this guy, thanks to those successes, is probably going to get a little bit more than that. Don't you think it's safe to speculate that he's going to get more? At least more than $30 million. Is it safe to speculate he'll get more than 42?
I think. It depends on the years and how they structure it. But I always like to try to stay away from the dollars as much as possible. But I mean, I think teams are going to value him higher than they valued Miguel Gonzalez. And if Gonzalez is getting $48 million,
right?
That's.
Yeah, I don't want to put a specific number on it, but that's what I'm saying. It does feel like the numbers are going to be pretty sick, pretty big.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right, let's touch on last week's prospect hot sheet, which is the whole raison d'etre of this podcast. And there's some names, some droids that Ben Badler told you to be looking for in last week's prospect hot sheet. First off, I mean, like Carlos Correa leading off. I mean, at number one, this guy's year just keeps getting better and better. I think it's hard to be the top overall pick and be overshadowed, but he kind of has been all year by Byron Buxton. But if you're the Astros or an Astros fan and you're looking at their rebuilding project, as bad as things are on the big league level, the rebuilding project's going pretty well, Ben, and it's not just guys from this regime, it's guys from the previous regime. But when you're Jeff Luhnow and you're through the first draft that he ran as general manager there, he and Mike Elias and that staff have to be pretty pleased with the debut professional season of full season of Carlos Correa.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a slow start for him, but other than that, it's been this guy is just outstanding. Like you said, it's hard to. You know, let's say Buxton hadn't been in the draft. I mean, you're right. I think Correa would be getting a lot more attention. I think we do give him a lot of attention anyway. But
right, it's not like we ignore him, but he doesn't feel like he's in the minor league player of the year debate. And I think the reason is that he was in the same league as Buxton, and Buxton was better. So
yeah, but I mean, Correa, you have, you know, you draft a guy at 17.
Yep.
He can actually just physically grow taller.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened with Correa. I mean, standing next to him at the Futures game, I was like, this guy looks like he's like 6'4", 6'5". Like, he was just physically imposing.
Yeah.
And the power that he showed there in batting practice, it hasn't shown up quite as much in games right now. It's more doubles.
Right.
Than balls over the fence right now. But and we brought up, you know, Manny Machado's name before. I think Machado, you know, because of how big I think Correa is going to be.
Yeah.
You know, I like it, the comparison offensively. It's two guys with really good hand-eye coordination. I actually think Correa has a more patient approach at the plate. And I think he's going to get, you know, a little bit higher ceiling just in terms of the on-base percentage. Maybe not the complete hand-eye, like the unbelievable hand-eye coordination that Machado has, where he's just, you know, he can really hit a pitch anywhere it is, even if it's off the plate, and drive it with some authority. But I think Correa has a, you know, better feel for the strike zone, or a little bit better plate discipline than Machado does. But I don't think he has that kind of quick twitch I don't think he's going to be as good in the field as Machado is. Which, I mean, Machado could be,
the Gold Glove guy. He's probably the best. He's the best. He might be one of the best shortstops in baseball if they didn't have JJ Hardy next to him.
So, but I think, you know, offensively, he's certainly going to, I think he's going to be in Machado's league. We're talking about, I don't know how fast they're going to try to move him through the system, but I mean, if he's in the big leagues by the time he's 20, I wouldn't be shocked at all. If he's not there by the time he's 22, I would be shocked.
I can't disagree with anything you just said. I mean, the guys this guy gets compared to are guys like Machado, Tulowitzki. If you like him at third base, it's like I remember the Astros, one of the Astros officials gave him slapped Aramis Ramirez on him. I mean, these are all really good players that he's getting compared to. You know, we'll see if he can stay at shortstop or has to move to third base. But the players he gets comped to are pretty amazing. And I just was looking up, and I'm not making this comparison. But I do think it's important to we mentioned Miguel Cabrera earlier in this podcast. You know, Miguel Cabrera played in the Midwest League as an 18-year-old. He had a 710 OPS with a 268, 328, 382 slash line, and he's 6'4". Correa, 18, Midwest League, 326, 407, 477 right now. You know, Cabrera the next year in the Florida State League is the stat line that's always seared in my head, that as a 19-year-old, he only hit 9 home runs in the Florida State League, but he had 43 doubles. And that's where I remember us writing, this guy's power potential is so significant. You know, to do that as a 19-year-old in the Florida State League, I remember scouts were really, really very high on him. And but Carlos Correa is basically doing that at a lower level, but also a year younger. It's scary upside for Carlos Correa. I think he's a special prospect. And, you know, like you said, I think he's gotten quite a bit of his due this year. But the other guys I wanted to bring up from the hot sheet, Ben, Ketel, is it pronounced Kettle or Ketel Marte?
The scouts I've talked to always pronounce it Ketel Marte. Yeah. But it's sometimes they don't know.
That's right. But Ketel Marte, the Mariners, just what the Mariners need. They've already graduated two shortstops to the big leagues this year, basically, and Nick Franklin moving him to second, and Brad Miller over at short. I just think there's a lot of irony there that an organization that probably has been as heavily involved as anyone internationally in the last 15 years has a college guy at shortstop. There are not that many U.S. college players playing shortstop in the big leagues, and the Mariners are one of them, and they have a U.S. high school guy playing second base. So as international as the Mariners have been, they have domestic middle infielders. But Ketel Marte just seems like a sleeper who's starting to make some noise, starting to get on the radar, but a guy that you were on 3 years ago is that people in that organization thought could develop.
Yeah, you know, when they signed him, that was the guy from that signing class in 2010. I think he had like $100,000, so they liked him. It just wasn't like a big frenzied market for him, but guy who was, you know, really good athlete, very smooth actions in the field, had some feel for putting the bats to the ball, very limited strength. So it's, you know, when you don't have much strength and you're, you know, 16, 17 years old, it's hard to do much at the plate, even if it's just, you know, you can make contact, but you're going to, you know, you're going to hit ground balls, but they're going to be slow. They're not going to get out of the infield. You're not going to be able to drive the ball too much. And he had a solid year, actually, in the Dominican Summer League his first year. We put him in the DSL top 20 list that we put out that year. I think that was the year we had Bogarts in it, too. But he was always just kind of this under-the-radar guy who, you know, there was always this, like, breakout potential with him. But with these, like even with, like, you talked about, like, Miguel Cabrera, who was certainly not under the radar. He was a huge deal when he signed.
It was like $1.9 million. I mean, that was in 1998 money. I mean, that was huge, yeah. Huge deal when he signed. So he had, I mean, he was kind of like the Miguel Sano of his day, basically, in terms of the attention that was on him from day one.
Yeah, but even he was like, there was always raw power there, but it wasn't showing up in games, really, until I think he was like 20 years old and then starting to hit double A. But with, you know, with Marte, you know, they pushed him, they skipped him over the Arizona League last year. They put him straight to the Northwest League, which should be an indicator that, all right, they really like this guy. But it was a very aggressive move. He struggled against a lot of guys who are, you know, just coming off their junior year out of college. They're sent to the Northwest League. Marte's an 18-year-old kid in the United States for the first time and facing those guys. He was pretty overmatched. I think he kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit. And then this year, to start out, he was, you know, nothing spectacular. And now, over the last, like, 2 weeks, he's been out of his mind. I think he was hitting, like over, like, 600 or something like that in his last, like, 50 at-bats. It's a very efficient swing, works for him. He puts the bat to the ball. It's, you know, a lot of doubles power. He's not going to knock the ball out of the park. He might be like a 5 to 10 home run guy. Although he's like 6'1", I could see him having a little bit more juice in there once he gets a little bit stronger and becomes more comfortable at the plate. But this could be a guy who really breaks out for them if he can keep this up. You know, for what's left of the season and next year, I think he's definitely a guy who's on the rise.
Yeah, and last but not least, you know, guy again who had some attention on him last year, Franklin Barreto, another guy who made the hot sheet this week at number 8. I just think it's natural to focus on some of the international signings with you, but Barreto, like you wrote on Friday, you get paid when you have present hitting ability in Latin America. This guy had present ability when he signed. He has present hitting ability now, and that's why he keeps on making prospect lists and has a lot of prospect buzz. Is Franklin Barreto just will not stop hitting.
Yeah, we put him number 1 on our July 2nd international list last year. If he didn't hit in the Gulf Coast League like this, I would have been very disappointed, because everybody I talked to. And it's just everywhere he's gone since he's like 10 years old. He's been in like Venezuelan international tournaments since I think he was like 10 years old, I'm pretty sure. I have to go back and check, but it certainly was when he was as young as 12. And everywhere he's gone, he's always been the best hitter everywhere he's been. He's played against, you know, Team USA. He dominates against them. He hit home runs in games. It's a very good swing. He just has such great feel for hitting. Now, he's like 5'9" and like 175 pounds, so it's like a thicker body. He's not going to play shortstop, I don't think, unless he makes some dramatic overhauls to his defense. But he's a good runner. You know, he was like a 70 runner when he signed. I don't know that speed is necessarily going to hold up, but I think he runs well enough where you can put him in either center field or you can put him at second base. Where, you know, arm strength is less of an issue, and the defensive demands aren't quite as high. So I think this is a guy who should hit a lot. I mean, he should move pretty quickly just because of how advanced of a hitter he is for his age. You know, the comparison that I've heard that I like the most is kind of like a Shane Victorino type of player. Not a real big guy, but just good feel for hitting. Probably hits you, you know, if you really like him, 15 to 20 home runs in his prime. There's a lot to like here. That was a really good sign by the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I mean, right now in the state of their farm system, he might be their top prospect in the whole Jays system.
Roberto Osuna is having some health issues with his arm. I mean, just the bat that he brings, he's, I don't know if he's going to be number 1 in that system or not, but he's certainly going to be somewhere near the top.
Going to be high, and it's not like they have a first-round pick from this year that's going to displace him. So,
no, I mean, DJ Davis is, you know, having a solid year. He's kind of slowed down a little bit.
I do love DJ Davis.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. You know, if Stroman is still there, he's in the mix. But obviously, they traded away, obviously, some of their better arms from the previous drafts who've all, you know, to their credit, worked out, you know, really well, were really good draft picks, but obviously they've thinned out their farm system a little bit with some of those trades.
No doubt. Ben, we've run well over an hour, but for an emergency podcast, we had a lot to say. So if you have more questions, obviously, for either one of us regarding Cuban players, Ben's seen them. Probably, Ben, I would say you're probably more informed about Cuban players than you've ever been, having gone to Japan to see them in the WBC, then come here and seen a second level of player here in Carey and Durham. And not so much just from seeing them, but seeing the scouts who see them as a matter of course, and really getting to know those guys even better, and really getting kind of almost ensconced really in Cuban coverage. And the timing, I think, fortuitous considering how many players are just coming out. So, great job. Enjoyed the write-up on Guerrero. Enjoyed the write-up on Gonzalez, and especially on Abreu yesterday. So, obviously, if people have more questions for Ben, hit him up at Ben Badler on Twitter, or hit me up at John Manuel BA, and I'll probably direct you to Ben. Anything else, Ben?
No, it's I think that's I mean, you've seen a lot of Cuban players coming over. I don't think it's going to slow down.
Doesn't seem like it's going to slow down. And in a country of 11 million, 11 and a quarter million, it's basically the same size, a little bit bigger than the Dominican Republic. So if Cuba were ever to open up, or it seems like it doesn't even need to open up, the amount of baseball talent coming out of that out of the island has not decreased. It does not seem. It just it ebbs and flows everywhere, and the flow right now is in hitters, and right now they're flowing to the United States, and Jose Abreu is the latest one. Good stuff, Ben. For Ben Battler, I'm John Manuel. You've been listening to another edition of the Baseball America Prospect Handbook Podcast, brought to you by DraftDay.com. For Ben, I'm John. So long, everybody.